Welcome to tonight's episode of Well-Rounded Corners. I'm Robert.
And I'm Ruth Ann.
And we're delighted to have with us this evening a very special guest, and we'll get to him in just a moment. I'd like to remind everybody about our website, wellroundedcorners.com. You can listen to all of our shows for free in the archives. Just click on shows at the top. Or you can go to BBS Radio and listen to our shows there. And I also want to let you know about our Facebook page. That's the best way to keep in touch with the shows coming up. We post the shows there when we put them in the archives. Just go to wellroundedcorners.com and click Facebook on the side, or you can search Well Rounded Corners on Facebook.
And we'd like to tell you a little bit about our special guest tonight. We are very honored to have Edward Ozoski on our show tonight, and he's an expert in the paranormal world and the study of paranormal phenomena. He has 30 years' experience in pioneering paranormal research, and Edward has the opportunity, he's had the opportunity to conduct preternatural research throughout the continental United States, instruct paranormal studies at the university level, and establish the research organization known as Hauntings Research. He is a professional member of the prestigious Rhine Research Center, located on the campus of Duke University. In addition, he is a member in many of the most renowned professional scientific societies in the United States. And welcome, Mr. Ozoski. How are you tonight?
I'm just great. How about yourself?
I'm just fine. How about you, Robert?
I'm doing pretty good. Can't complain.
We are so glad to have you on tonight.
Well, it's actually my honor. I'm honored to be on.
Well, thank you.
Yep. So, you know, I was looking at your bio and you know, looking at your information, and I wanted to start with a little bit about, I mean, I know, you know, when we talk about paranormal studies, that includes so many different things. And I wanted to really kind of get a handle on what your current interest is. What are you, you know, what's your current focus right now? What are your thoughts on just the entire subject of paranormal, how that fits into our daily lives?
Well, as you mentioned, paranormal is a very large umbrella, and it can include anything from, you know, Bigfoot to UFOs to you know, whatever. But our focus is on the life after death phenomena and how it applies to our everyday consciousness and actually how it fits into a lot of the religious teachings, especially here in the Western hemisphere of Christianity, with the whole concept of life after death.
That's you know, I guess that's a defining feature of humans, is that, you know, we ponder that, and so much of our energy is spent in that, ironically, of our you know, time when we're alive. Are you focusing on the life? I'm assuming you've studied near death experiences and worked with those as a you know, it's just a glimpse into that possible future.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I have. When I speak of the life after death experience, I generally look at it as a two-pronged study. There's the what I call the paranormal end of it, which is life after death, as I mentioned, reincarnation, and of course the NDE or near death experience. Those are actually three prongs, or evidence routes, if you will, to the paranormal aspect of it. I also have a background in the parapsychology end of it, in, let's say, ESP, clairvoyance, telepathy, psychokinesis, things that were generally studied in laboratory situations. The paranormal umbrella that covers all of this, both aspects, both modalities of study, paranormal and parapsychology, all are achieving or trying to achieve the same end, and that is to get some understanding of exactly what happens at the moment that life ends as we know it here on Earth.
Well, there are so many ways that we can look at it. I mean, from you can look at it from the aspect of here is my evidence. I have this voice that I can't explain any other way. Where did that come from? You can look at it from the psychological standpoint. You can look at it from the shamanic or energy standpoint. You can look at it from or the religious standpoint. And I guess my question would be to you, I mean, it seems to me that the belief systems have kind of evolved over time as to what's acceptable, what's mainstream, what's woo-woo or out there. And I'd like to since you've been doing this for such a long time, I'd like to get your view on how it's shifted and changed and how it all works together and where we are now.
Well, you almost need a scorecard to keep track of all of this. you know, it's stay tuned, and I'll let you know what the changes are tomorrow. I think that a lot of what we are taught here in, let's say, the United States anyway, what we're taught here centers around the whole concept of heaven and hell, and I think that's basically how most people perceive the life after death phenomena. But I think the roots go back a long, long, long way. As a matter of fact, we were talking about the whole concept of near-death experience that you had mentioned. And Plato, I believe, in his work, The Republic, actually told a story about a soldier who was recounting his near-death experience directly after a battle. So it's something that really, really goes back quite a long ways. The only variance in it is how, from my perception, is how religions tend to spin it, so to speak. To give you a good example, I grew up Catholic, and in my early years, in Catholic grade school, we were taught that there was heaven, hell, but there was an in-between step. There was a purgatory. Now, years later, it was the purgatory disappeared. The Catholic Church says, never mind, we're not going to, that doesn't exist. Well, at one time it exists, at one time it doesn't. So that's kind of where I was kidding around with the you know, stay tuned until tomorrow, because the religion in this country appears to fluctuate in its perception of life after death very slightly, but it does. And I believe that the whole concept of heaven and hell is nothing more than, like I said, what Plato was talking about, what Jeffrey Long in his books about near-death experience, that people perceive things very, very differently due to their religious upbringings.
Yes.
And I believe that a lot of the concept of heaven, as we know it, is really based on the individual's perception upon death. And I think that's based primarily on where they were in religious teachings at the time of death.
Yes.
And I think that influences a lot of what we hear about, especially with near-death experience individuals that come back and tell us their experiences. While there's a certain thread that runs through them, routinely, you do hear various fluctuations as far as what they perceived their experience was.
Well, do you find I had a near-death experience myself many years ago, and I found that it took me over a year to really feel like I was back, if that makes sense. I was kind of between the two places, and I've never really been the same. And I know I've heard, I mean, I've read some about the subject, not a lot, but enough to know that other people have said the same. What does your research show about that? I mean, how it changes people and how they feel about being back.
One of the threads that appears to run through all of the encounters is that feeling that it changes your life.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, the individual, as he recalls the events after he left the body, tends to vary. However, in the end, my research has found that almost without exception, every person that has had some type of an experience, and that includes the soldier back in Plato's Republic, mentioned a life-changing view. So there is, I believe, a physiological or mental aspect to it, but I also believe there is a certain fundamental spiritual change as well, which of course cannot be measured, and I think that's why your experience in taking about a year to really come to grips with it is not unusual. I think that it's something that if you try to approach it from a logical point of view, you cannot. The afterlife precludes our scientific rules, our sense of logic. There is no common explanation for that. It's a feeling that you have. It's very individual, and it's something that's probably very difficult to put into words because of the fact that it's a feeling.
True. Very true. And I would agree. I mean, what was interesting, I mean, I won't go into mine, but what was interesting was that as far as what my religious beliefs at that time were, it wasn't what I would have expected. And so, although I agree with you, I know what you're saying, that when people think about death and come close to it and prepare for it or start to cross over, then they react often in a way that relates to their religious background and beliefs. But I thought it was very interesting that it wasn't what I would have expected according to my Catholic religion at that time. I was Catholic. And mm-hmm. I just thought that was very interesting, and I didn't expect that.
It is interesting. As a matter of fact, I'm rather surprised, to be honest with you. There is a New York Times bestseller, and forgive me, I do not know the name of it. Maybe some of your listeners know. But it was about a young boy who had a near-death experience. And in his experience, he detailed meeting a very, very, very large God who sat on a throne. And that, of course, kind of points to what I was mentioning before, that that perception, I believe, is very strongly rooted in his religious teaching up until he had that experience.
Well, you know, now that you said that just a moment, it occurred to me why it didn't match what my religion was at the time. I don't think I was in the right religion in the first place. It didn't match what I really did believe, which did go with what I experienced, if that makes sense.
Yes, it certainly does.
And
it certainly
that made
does.
Me,
and
yes.
And I, truthfully, I can identify with that. While still being Catholic, my beliefs are a little more independent than the traditional strict Catholic. And as such, for instance, my concept of heaven is not the pearly gates, you know, the little angels with wings on them and people strumming on harps. You know, my concept of it is more in tune with the ancient Greeks' philosophy of spiritualism, where we pass into, the soul passes into a very spiritual realm,
yes.
And we seek the level of spirituality that we feel comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you call that heaven or whether you call it by some other name, I believe that we're all discussing the same thing. But like I said, that obviously is not quite exactly textbook, you know, Catholic dogma.
Well, sure. Well, something I've noticed, and I was thinking of this when you were you know, discussing the, you know, various takes on it, but we all sort of arrive at some similar things. There seem to be some big cognitive or big elements of cognitive dissonance that I see in different interpretations of the same thing. For example, you know, reincarnation. I hear people, you know, like in the Eastern religions, the reincarnation is more, you don't know your past lives. It's just, it is what it is. You move to the next and you don't know. And, you know, in the West, we have this kind of idea of reincarnation that, oh, I was, you know, this person in the past life, you know, or I were these three famous people. And, you know, it's a very different thing. And just the idea of reincarnation itself, if we are to have new lives, if we are to experience, you know, learn from and have, you know, future lives, then being bogged down in past ones or researching past ones might be, you know, sort of a different, maybe counterintuitive in a way, just from a, you know, one perspective. And the same thing would exist, I think, of like eternal life. I mean, you know, if you have the concept of eternal life and then you have, you know, a competing concept of reincarnation, how do those two reconcile? Because, I mean, they come from the same idea of life after death. One says, you know, you'll just always be this. It kind of is a death. And the other says, you know, you're going to be reborn. But it just seems like even contained in some of the same theories, there is a dissonance of the implementation of how it works. Things just don't add. And is that just competing, you know, in your opinion in research, is that competing opinions, competing mindsets? So what accounts for those kind of things?
I think you just hit it right on the button. It's competing mindsets, competing philosophies, competing theories. Now, I was strongly influenced by Dr. Ian Stevenson, or the late Dr. Ian Stevenson, at the University of Virginia. And I consider Dr. Stevenson to be maybe the Western pioneer, if you will, of reincarnation and reincarnation research. If your listeners aren't familiar with Dr. Stevenson, I would suggest a book. It was written in 1974, I believe. It's called 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation, an excellent book. Dr. Stevenson was well-renowned for his very meticulous scientific modality. He was meticulous in researching and with scientific methodology. It's a fascinating book from both a psychological point of view as well as a scientific point of view. As a matter of fact, in that book, he gave various reasons for the best possible explanation for reincarnation. And as I recall, I think the large number of witnesses and the lack of apparent motive would be one. A second, let's say, what do I want to call them? Proof of a scientific proof would be the large amount of information that a child could possess and not be the result of contact that he may have made with somebody. A third was characteristics and skills that could not be learned in the current life. And the fourth one that I recall was that a correlation between congenital deformities or birthmarks that were possessed by the child. So he, in his work, took that to a very, very specific point of proof, and his reading is a must for anybody that has any interest whatsoever in reincarnation and the possibility that helps to provide proof for
now, what was his name again?
Death.
Just so we can
Dr. Ian Stevenson.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I'll have to look that up. That
I want to make
very interesting.
Yeah, make a note of that for our listeners. And we'll have it on the show.
I will repeat the book. It's 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation. And it was published, like I said, around 1974. It's an excellent book.
Okay.
Well, you know, this is such an interesting topic to me. I do energy work with clients, and I have to say there are many times – see, I have a science background, and I get very caught between what I experience in my energy work, which is completely different, although it goes together perfectly for me personally. But I find – you know, myself trying to say, well, scientifically this and this, when what I experience and feel is not always what I was taught in science class. And so I get kind of caught between the two worlds sometimes. And sometimes when I work on clients, there are things I see and feel that I'm not sure what else they would be. But on the other hand, I can't sit and give proof, so I'm left in that I know what I experience and I know what I see, and that's what it makes sense to me to be, but there's the science, the scientific side of me saying, well, you can't prove that. So, you know, I get caught between, you know what I'm trying to say? It is so fascinating to me because when I look at what I find sometimes with people, I say, whoa, I don't know what else that could be.
And I would agree with that 100%. I go through the exact same attempt for reconciliation. The problem, obviously, as I mentioned before, you cannot apply the laws of physics of quantum mechanics. You cannot apply logic. It just doesn't work. Those are laws that just do not apply to the spiritual end of existence.
True.
And to give you a good example, and I talk about this a lot, during the course of our research, as we're into a situation where we are investigating some claims, we do what's known as EVPs, electronic voice phenomena. And what that encompasses is sitting down in a room, maybe alone or with a couple colleagues, with a digital recorder, and we ask very specific questions. And the intent is to try to get very specific answers. Now, when we go back to do analysis and we listen to those sound files, when we hear very specific responses to a very specific question in an empty room,
mm-hmm.
that's where I have the same problem. How do I explain that? How do I wrap my mind around that? Because scientifically, that's impossible.
Yes.
Spiritually, we have more than enough evidence that it occurs.
Yes,
so,
yes. You know, I have the same experience when I get a message for someone when I'm working with them, or when I see something that I sometimes there just is no way I would know that, and so the science part of me goes, yes, but it could be this, that, but it's not. And so,
yeah.
You know, it's like you said in the empty room, you know, well, who was that? If you've accounted for everybody and contamination, I mean, to me, there comes a point when you've exhausted all the other reasons, all the other logic, when you either are stubborn and say it can't be because to you it feels for some, not you personally, but to someone it feels threatening or impossible or outside their box, there comes a time when you don't say, well, you know, I can't think of anything else it could be. When if you can't, you know, have that possibility, then it's almost just being stubborn, in, from what I see.
I would agree. As a matter of fact, I recently wrote a paper to the Rhine Research Center, of course, which I'm a professional member. And in that, I suggested that I believe the time has come for those people in the parapsychology field to kind of lob the ball into the skeptics' court. I think that we have people like J.B. Rhine of Duke University, and of course I mentioned Dr. Stevenson at the University, the late Dr. Stevenson, University of Virginia, who spent literally 30, 40 years of meticulously gathering scientific evidence that there is something outside of the body that is going on. And after 30 and 40 years of meticulous research, to have somebody just arbitrarily wave it off with their hand and say, I don't believe it. I think that, you know, enough's enough. I think instead of us running back and trying to get more evidence, I think it's time that the skeptics prove that our information is incorrect.
I agree with you, but I hear so often, people in the purely scientific camp will say, well, you know, a lot of this is based on anecdotal evidence, and, you know, the phrase that kills me, anecdotal evidence is irrelevant. Well, it's obviously not irrelevant. I mean, you know, here's the thing. When you're dealing with something that is so, it's outside our dimension of common experience that, I mean, how can you possibly repeat it when it's not something that necessarily you have any control over? You know, you could even argue that maybe you could say, you know, did he have a heart attack? Well, only if he can repeat it. You know, I mean, that gets a little silly to me. And but that's the thing that seems to keep on getting thrown back is it repeatable? Is it verifiable? You know, and you can have 10 different people see it, and that's not good enough. It's got to be. I don't know what it has to be for some reason.
Well, I think what's interesting is that I hear people say, well, that's irrelevant and it doesn't matter what the research said. That can't be until their grandmother talks to them in the middle of the night or at the corner in the grocery store. And then it's funny that it's not quite so irrelevant.
You know, isn't that the truth? 20 years ago, if a scientist would have talked about the God particle, which is responsible for the Big Bang, there was no proof for it, absolutely no proof whatsoever. So it doesn't exist, correct? Well, here we are today with the God particle, and it does exist. So saying, you know, that something is does not exist because they cannot see it or they cannot hear it is absolutely ridiculous. And to me, it's lazy. It's nothing more than lazy research. And that's why I say, I think a similar amount of energy needs to be expended by the skeptics to prove that some of the hardcore evidence that we do have, it's time for them to prove that is not correct, that it doesn't exist. And I think that if they go about that, I think that eventually they will start to realize, hey, maybe there is something to this. You know, take the blinders off.
Yes.
And it just infuriates me, like I said, to see some absolutely brilliant people spend 30 and 40 years of their life documenting things, and for somebody to come along who has done no research and just dismiss it verbally.
Yeah.
Which shows just as much of a bias as the person who's saying, this is what we find. They accuse many times and say, oh, you have a bias, you want that to be true. And then I would say, well, you don't want it to be true. So I guess maybe we meet in the middle and look at the evidence.
I would actually go one further and say, why do you not want it to be true? Because to me, I mean, you know, and granted, this is a non-scientific thought, but to me, the idea of a spiritual world a world that exists beyond our common experience, a world that or the existence of consciousness, or maybe not consciousness, it's not really the right word, but the existence of spirit after death means that there is more to all this than just what it is. And why is that scary to some people? I mean, I think you could turn that question around easily.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, no way to prove this either, but I would venture that there is a very significant percentage of those people that have a change of mind when they're laying on their deathbed.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to believe that a very goodly percentage of those people are probably starting to rethink that whole thing.
I would say that that's definitely true. I would have to say, yes, I worked in healthcare before and seen that exact thing happen, and I would agree with you there. So, yes.
It's funny. Well, actually, we need to start with this over the break. Or after the break, we need to take a break now. We're so lucky to have with us tonight.
Yes.
A wonderful guest. it is so neat how all the different I came into this interview. A lot of people talk about the paranormal, but so few do it with the scientific clarity, that you have done, and that is really neat. It brings almost some. I don't want to say credibility because we were just arguing that all of that is credible, but what I'm trying to. It gives us a common thing to point at and say, look, there is some evidence of this. And that's so nice to do. I'm so glad you're bringing that because that's really, really amazing.
No, thank you for the kind words.
Yeah. So we'll be back after the break here in just a minute.
Want to start a website but don't know how? No problem. The experts at OCS Solutions have you covered. We offer a complete range of internet services from domain name registration, web hosting, and even our easy-to-use website building tool that allows you to create a website with just a few clicks and be live in minutes. Pick from thousands of templates and samples, upload your own content, or use a mix of both. It's entirely up to you. And don't worry, you won't outgrow OCS. We host websites both small and large. Domain names start at just $8 a year and come loaded with plenty of extras to get you started. Visit OCSDomains.com to learn more or call 1-800-672-8415. That's OCSDomains.com or call 1-800-672-8415.
Reiki is a Japanese relaxation technique that promotes healing and balance. It is a form of energy work that helps unblock areas that are affected by illness, stress, grief, anxiety, or other types of trauma, and it can be given in person or from the Reiki practitioner to the recipient at a distance. It is gentle and soothing and is simple to learn as well. Our bodies have the natural ability to maintain health and heal themselves when energy flows smoothly throughout our energy system, and Reiki works well either by itself or along with traditional or alternative medical treatments to help keep energy channels flowing and the mind and body in balance. I offer Reiki, the Ho Chi, and other types of energy sessions in my home in Florence, Alabama, as well as distance Reiki to any location in the world. I also teach Reiki classes from levels 1 through Karuna Reiki Master, as well as the Ho Chi. To learn more, please visit alabamareiki.com. That's alabamareiki.com.
Welcome back from the break, and we are lucky to have with us tonight Edward Ozoski, and he is a paranormal researcher, and we've had a wonderful time talking to him tonight, and we're glad you're with us tonight. I had a question. Well, actually, I have so many questions. I could talk to you for hours, actually. We're so glad you're with us tonight. I'd like to ask you about your teaching. How do you approach the topics that you teach as a paranormal studies instructor?
Very carefully.
good answer.
Believe me, it is such a popular topic that that people come very much prepared with their own theories and their own views. In addition to that, unfortunately, maybe, is the advent of cable television's paranormal shows, which, while it has raised awareness and helped promote people, let's say, coming out of the closet as believers, it has, as a bad effect, it's provided a lot of very, very bad information, false information. People are coming away from the programs, one, thinking that the Hollywood version of the paranormal is the way the world is, and two, they're coming away thinking that, okay, I've watched this now for a year on several different programs, I'm now an expert. And I can't.
I think you have to watch three seasons at least, right?
That's what I tell them. Wait, how many shows? Three shows minimum. I can't even begin to tell you how many people really believe that they have a very good handle on this whole subject, and. So when we do begin a course, that's one of the things from a negative point of view that that I have to address. And that's why I say very, very cautiously, because people have very, very strong ideas and very, very strong opinions. And I do get hit on occasion with the, well, you know, have you ever tried to... do a double-blind study. Well, you know, if I could do that, yeah, I guess that would be a nice idea. But unless, you know, they have
you,
a way
you design
of,
an experiment and get back with me. And
good luck with that one.
Yeah. Really, and that has been brought up several times. So, you know, it wasn't a flip response when I said very cautiously. It takes a lot of preparation. And I have to be prepared for a lot of different views.
You know, something that we talked about before the break, and this is just, it's been an interesting perspective for me. You know, my grandmother has a terminal diagnosis with cancer, and she's, you know, been living with us. So we've kind of gotten to see firsthand some of the things, you know, not really necessarily life after death sort of things, but just it's been very interesting, you know, the amount of psychic episodes and the amount of shall we say just, you know, her awareness of things that there's no other way to be aware of, conversations that are not had around here or just things that are completely outside her perception, you know, her knowing about, and you know, just her sort of view on things. I mean, it's very you know, she's very, very religious. Not very religious, but I mean, you know, she was a church-going person all her life. And, you know, she just seems to be sort of now in the more agnostic sort of mode. And it's interesting how when what I've seen, and I guess already knew this at some level, but it's been interesting to see this progression, you know, from if I, you know, objectify and say, all right, this is not my grandmother, that's the hard part. But, you know, when I look at it and I say, wow, this is kind of neat in a way, because she's getting back to her perception of spirituality that we have as a kid, sort of before we're indoctrinated with a bunch of stuff, whatever that stuff may be. You know, it's a very pure experience that she relates when she says she saw that thing or heard that thing that didn't really make sense or we didn't think happened. So, I mean, is there any work that's been done or anything that you're aware of with these kind of patients that, you know, might – I mean, it's been enlightening to me, and I'm sure that this isn't the only, you know, case. I'm sure there's dozens out there, many, many out there like this, where the caregivers and the patient themselves get a new perspective on spirituality that they hadn't had, you know, with a terminal diagnosis.
I believe that happens every day. I believe it happens every minute of every day. I think there has been a lot of documentation, especially from people in, let's say, hospice or in short-term care facilities, doctors. I think it's been pretty well documented amongst those people that there is a certain unscientific, as far as testing goes, an unscientific occurrence that that people go through, and I think it's a natural transition, even for the most hardy of skeptics, and I don't think it's unusual at all. As a matter of fact, as I mentioned, I think it happens every single minute of every single day. And when the time comes, I'm sure that that I will go through the same process. Now, I'm fortunate in that I've done many, many, many years of research in my life so that I'm preparing myself for what I believe is going to happen. And I'm hoping by doing shows like this that I can help send some of the information to people such as your grandmother about what we know currently awaits her. And I hope that they take that they're given strength by understanding that that there is something, you know, that's going to go on. There is something that is going to keep them in existence.
Well, if you wouldn't mind, you know, it's such a personal question, and you're sharing what you believe, but you said what we know. You said that key phrase there. So what do we know? I mean, what can we – and let me qualify first by saying that when I say no, I mean, obviously there is a certain amount of – I guess with any kind of quote-unquote fact, there is a certain amount of ambiguity we don't know about some things. But what is the general accepted course that you
– from all that you've come across in your
– from your research, from your experiences, you know, in the subject.
Well, once again – I'm going to have to fall back into the life after death studies, such as reincarnation, such as near-death experiences, and even to a certain degree, even some of the parapsychology tests that have been done in the laboratories. I think that there is enough evidence from what I've seen in my lifetime to say with a good degree of certainty that when we do research into a purported haunting, I'm going to say, we have been given information, names, dates, locations, which we have been able to verify historically. Where we have been able to go to a city courthouse, we've been able to go into the death records and actually verify what we're being told. So when I say we know, that's what I'm referring to. I'm referring to situations where souls that have passed on are giving us their names, are giving us their locations, are giving us their dates, and we're being able to verify that those names, those locations, and those dates are genuine. Now, that's pretty strong evidence to my mind.
That's probably as good as it gets.
And that's where I get a bit frustrated sometimes when you have that kind of, and yes, it is evidence. Yeah, if you had no idea of those facts and someone is telling you, I am so-and-so, and whatever they tell you, and you look it up and yes, it is, you didn't go in there loaded with the information.
That's correct.
How else did you get? I mean, there is a time when common sense says, you know what, maybe I need to rethink this. Maybe something else is going on here. I mean, there are some times when you can say, well, maybe you already knew. And maybe in some, but not with this kind of thing. No, you didn't. And that brings me to,
I was curious about the general accepted, you know, life after death, what from your research, did you, I don't know if we gave him an adequate chance to, I think he was in the middle of that, or maybe you were, I don't know if you were still in the middle of that thought.
Well, let me sum it up. I believe that there is enough existence from the 30 years of research, study, and investigation that I've done that I will go to my grave knowing that there is life after death. I have no question in my mind about it whatsoever. And as I tell people, I'm not a missionary. My job on this earth is not to convert anyone to anything. What I do is I go out, I collect evidence in a very scientific manner. I present it in as straightforward a manner as I can. And it's up to the people that listen to it and see it to do with it as they choose. I respect everyone's opinions, but in my 30 years, I have seen so much evidence that just is unexplainable by any current scientific methodology. I've seen enough evidence that I will definitely go to my grave saying there is an existence when we pass from the body.
It's pretty concrete. I mean, I think that
brings me to the connection between collecting evidence. I mean, I'm not sure sometimes when I've talked to someone who is in academics or is showing is. It, not even an academics, how shall I put this? Someone who is finding concrete scientific, as much as possibly scientific, evidence of something that is this kind of topic. I find a disconnect sometimes between the professional attitude of getting the evidence, which is a wonderful way to be, and the person who, let's say, does talk to spirits or does see them or does get this, or does energy, whatever. I find a kind of a disconnect. It's like, well, no, I need to do a controlled experiment here and I need to see it. And I don't really want to see, join together with you. If you say, well, I do that naturally, is there something I can, you know what I'm trying to say? Do you feel that disconnect or this seems to me something that it would be, you know, you could go, no, I'm only going to do this with scientific evidence, or you could say, I will work with someone who naturally does see these things or does this. And how do you feel about that?
Well, if I'm understanding the question correctly,
I didn't ask it very well, and I apologize.
as to whether or not it goes back to what we discussed earlier about the problem of mentally feeling like something is possible, but scientifically not being able to prove it.
Yes,
I think I'm going to give you a real case that actually occurred in 1958. It's called the Seifert case. And it happened in Long Island, New York, Nassau County. And in it, a young boy, about approximately 13 years of age, began experiencing psychokinetic activity. And as it spread through the house, it became so disruptive and so well known that the Nassau police force was involved. A full-time Nassau County detective was assigned to the house. Mental health researchers, doctors, were all involved. And the reason I bring this up is Bill Roll, who was associated at the time with Duke University, and Dr. Gaither, who was also associated with Duke University in laboratory testings, went up to the Herman family home to witness what was going on. Now, from February 3rd to March 10th, so a little more than a month, this psychokinetic activity continually happened. Dr. Roll and Dr. Gaither from Duke, now we're talking two of the preeminent minds in parapsychology, went up and spent the time there. They documented 67 psychokinetic events. We're talking only in the span of a little more than a month, 67 documented events. And of those, when they wrote up their official report, 17 of those could not be explained. Now, 17, to my mind, is a very large percentage.
Yes.
And we are talking two of the preeminent researchers from a scientific point of view from Duke University that witnessed it themselves and could not scientifically come up with any explanation for 17 of those events. That's where we get into this. I see it mentally. I see it and understand what's going on, but scientifically I can't prove it. So it's documented. Does that answer your question, by the way?
Well, I think pretty much so. I think you addressed that. I guess I see people say sometimes, and I do not for any moment believe that everyone who says, I talked to your great Aunt Sophie, really talked to great Aunt Sophie. I mean, I'm not naive. I also do see that there are some people who are gifted in being able to communicate or being able to perceive things that I think we all have the ability to sense, but we're taught not to listen to that, not to trust ourselves, that you couldn't have seen that, you couldn't have heard that, you couldn't have whatever. And so I would like to see, I mean, to me, the disconnect sometimes where, you know, someone says, this did happen and she said this and I can't explain it. If it's not done in front of the researchers, can be anecdotal. And I guess my hope is that those are not dismissed. I guess that's what I'm trying to say, that it's okay. A teamwork. Do you know what I'm trying to say now? I don't know if I even still, I don't know if I have words to ask my question.
Actually, if I can give you another example, maybe this will be a little bit closer. There was a woman by the name of Eileen Garrett back in the 1930s. Now, Eileen Garrett was the greatest medium of her time, and she made, you know, the claims. She claimed to be able to contact and interact with spirits. Mm-hmm. She was brought in for testing by Dr. J.B. Ryan at Duke University, and they tested her medium abilities. Mm-hmm. By use of Zener cards, if you're familiar with those.
Yes.
For your listeners, Zener cards are it's a pack of that includes five distinctive symbols. And the trick is mixing them up at random outside of the influence of the medium, and then having the medium tell what order or what card is currently being shown. Now, statistically, in using mathematics, statistically, 20% of guesses is what you would expect from a person that comes in with no ability and is just guessing. That's the mathematical equivalent of the best of guesses, 20%. Eileen Garrett consistently scored in the 30%.
Hmm.
There was also a gentleman around the same time named Hubert Pierce. And for, a good decade, he was the center of a lot of testing in the laboratories at Duke University. And Hubert Pierce also scored in the mid-30s.
Wow.
So if mathematically guessing is the best you can do is 20%, consistently, time after time after time, doing 30% shows that there are people that do have a talent.
Yes.
Oh, for sure.
And so you bring the two together. You bring what someone says he or she does or can do to make it a scientific, a more scientific or a provable. And I see what you're saying, when we all work together.
And that's probably, to my knowledge, about as close as any scientific experiment can get to marrying the paranormal with the scientific.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, it's been wonderful having you on. We really appreciate it. We're unfortunately out of time.
Yes,
but
we could talk about this for hours. And
we could. And I hope someday we can.
On.
Yeah, I would like to have you back on because I feel we have a lot more to discuss here. But you've given me a lot of insight, and I'm sure our listeners have really. Just enjoyed the information depth that you've added to this. It's
do you have some contact information or a website?
Yes.
Yes.
We're about to close here, but we'd like that if you
For your listeners.
Excuse me. We really do have to close. We've run over. But if you'll give us that off the air, the contact information, we'll put that on our website.
I will do that.
Okay. If you'll we'll definitely put that on there. Thank you again for being on. We'll hope to have you back.
Check us out.
And good night, everyone. We appreciate you listening.
WellRoundedCorners.com. Mm-hmm.